The Leonard Lopate Show really needs your help. We are conducting an anonymous 5-minute survey to learn a bit about you and the podcast that you love. So visit wmyc.podcastingsurvey.com to find it, or click on the link in our show notes or on our show page. We'd really appreciate your help. Knowing more about you helps us put together more of the shows that you enjoy. Again, that's wnyc.podcastingsurvey.com. Thank you from all of us at The Leonard Lopate Show.
You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Remember late 2014 when Hillary Clinton was considered by almost everyone to be a shoo-in for the presidency? She'd been first lady, then a successful senator from New York, and two-thirds of Americans approved of her job performance when she was Secretary of State. She was so popular that she campaigned for Democrats in Senate races across the country, and a super PAC founded by her friends was already amassing millions of dollars to fund her run. How she lost, despite all those advantages, is the subject of a new book by political journalists Jonathan Allen and Amy Parnas called Shattered, Inside Hillary Clinton's Doomed Campaign. It's published by Crown, and I'm very pleased it has brought Jonathan Allen back to our show. Welcome back.
It's always a pleasure to be here.
From the very beginning of her campaign, Hillary Clinton seems to have been haunted by the mistakes that were made during her run against Barack Obama. What were some of the biggest gaffes in 2008?
Well, I think in 2008, she ran as a candidate of the status quo against a candidate who was offering change. And she said she was going to be the person who could practically get things done and had the experience. She ran as the qualified candidate. And interestingly, in 2016, that's essentially what she did again.
But there were similar problems also. There was dissension within the campaign in 2008. There was a sense there was no clear vision for the country, and she was also running away from the idea that she would be the first woman to be president of the United States.
In terms of the dissension in the ranks, the big change this time is they were able to keep most of that under wraps. People were afraid to come out and leak to the press about problems that they had internally to try to air grievances. There was a real concern because she had focused after 2008 on basically stomping down on leaks, and people were afraid to do it. They were worried it would cost them their White House job. This time around, she was good at keeping the leaks in, but I think what she didn't really necessarily grasp from 2008 is that the leaking and the dissension internally were symptoms of the problems with her campaign, not the actual problems.
What about the role of Bill Clinton? At times he seemed to be a loose cannon in 2008, and to a lesser degree, but still also in the more recent campaign.
They tried to keep him a little bit more closely in coordination this time with the campaign, and he had a lot of contact with Robbie Mook, the campaign manager. It's interesting, this time around, Bill Clinton offered his thoughts on what they should be doing that they weren't doing, and they were often rejected as sort of old school politics, the art of persuasion, the art of politics, as opposed to the hard data science that Robbie Mook preferred.
Obviously, he didn't know what he was doing. He only was reelected, despite having to face a major scandal. You write that in the 7 years between the 2008 run and 2015's announcement, she rebuilt her political organization, and part of that involved punishing the people she saw as disloyal. How had they been disloyal?
So in at the end of the 2008 campaign, two of her aides drew up a spreadsheet of all the Democratic members of Congress and ranked them on a loyalty score level from 1 to 7. And the 7s were the most disloyal. And the way you became seen as disloyal is if you were somebody she believed should have been with her because of past relationship or for other factors, and then you went with Barack Obama. And so some people, the Illinois delegation, Barack Obama's home state, they were kind of given a pass on that. Some of the African-American members of Congress were given a pass on that. But she maintained that list, and then over the course of the next few election cycles, Bill Clinton went out in Democratic primaries and campaigned for the opponents of some of these people, knocked some of them out of office. And what happened is beyond those few people that he actually took out of office, there became a fear among Democratic Party leaders that there was a cost associated with going against the Clintons, whereas they might not be punished by another candidate who they didn't go with. For instance, if you went with Hillary Clinton, Bernie Sanders wasn't going to be able to punish the entire Democratic Party if he won a nomination. So there was a calculation in that, and I think it helped clear the field for her. She ended up having a tough run against Bernie Sanders, but I don't think anybody would have predicted that when he first launched his bid, and many others stayed out of the race.
Her fear was Joe Biden.
Her big fear was Joe Biden. He had the capacity to draw against her from a couple of different bases. He certainly would have had the ability to get some of the working class whites that he has a connection with. But more important, he would have had some lines into the African American community, into the Latino community, and into the LGBT community, areas where she really needed to run up the score to ensure that she had the delegates to win the primary.
So she was helped by the fact that he just decided not to run.
Absolutely.
Was he pressured not to run?
I don't think he was pressured not to run. I think that, it was a complicated calculation for him. He was always thinking about his son, who tragically died, as being the person that he was going to get behind after being the vice president. When his son died, his son had been ill for a while. You know, he'd been thinking about running for president. His son died. That changed the discussion a little bit for a while. It certainly delayed him making a decision. The Clinton people tried to give him significant room, and then finally, right before he pulled out, they started saying he's got to make a decision one way or the other.
You write that one of the problems she had was that she had no real explanation of why she was running. But didn't she say that she was running to make our economy work for you and every American, invoking that I'm going to help the middle class thing that politicians always say?
She said that in her launch speech at Roosevelt Island here in New York. And she said there were a lot of other reasons that she was running for president. But I think a lot of voters looked at what she was saying and said she's for everything, which means she's not for anything. And particularly in the general election, I think, you know, Donald Trump had a very clear message, not necessarily one that everyone liked, but it was very clear what Donald Trump was saying he would do with the presidency. With her, it was an entire panoply of sort of generic Democratic policies.
And, of course, Bernie Sanders also was very clear in what he would want to do. But let's get back to that Roosevelt Island launch. In 2008, she went to Iowa, a state that she hoped she might very well win. Actually, wasn't that more like the sort of thing that is suggested she should have done this time? Why would she go to Roosevelt Island in New York?
Well, I think, number one, they weren't entirely sure what Iowa was going to look like when they started this campaign. And there's always a question of how much emphasis you want to put on Iowa, the first state. She had lost it in 2008. Bill Clinton had lost it in 1992. This was not a state that was particularly favorable to her, and in fact was very favorable to Bernie Sanders demographically. In addition to that, she was looking for a historic place to launch from, something that if she were to win the presidency, you could look back and put as a sort of historic marker. And, from her perspective, what better place to find a unifying force for Democrats than Franklin Roosevelt on Roosevelt Island? She wanted to talk about the same kind of values that he spoke about in his Four Freedoms speech, which was about a year before we got into World War II. The freedom from want, the freedom from fear, et cetera. I think that tied into the message that she wanted to send. And, of course, in the backdrop when you're on Roosevelt Island is the United Nations building, which is a reminder of Eleanor Roosevelt, who was instrumental in the creation of the UN Declaration of Human Rights. So I think there was a lot of symbolism for her there. And, of course, this is her at least adopted home state.
My guest is Jonathan Allen, who is co-author with Amy Parnas of Shattered, Inside Hillary Clinton's Doomed Campaign. Well, Bernie Sanders' message and Hillary's message weren't all that different. Why did his come across so much more clearly?
I think part of it is that he paints in big, bold, bright colors. When he says he's going to do something, he says, I'm going to do it. He says, not going to do something, I'm not going to do it. You often hear both sides from Hillary Clinton, and that doesn't mean that she doesn't have a real feeling about the policy that she's pushing forward. It just means she tends to have a nuanced view, and it was very difficult for her to contrast herself with Bernie Sanders. The other thing is, he had a real feel for the rise in populism in the country, as did Donald Trump, and this was something that was very anathema to her. As we report in the book, after the New Hampshire primary, she confided to a friend of hers, Mignon Moore, on a flight. They were flying back and forth. Hillary Clinton was in a not despondent, but a pretty despairing mood. And she said, you know, I don't really understand what's going on in the country right now. I can't get my arms around it. And she continued to express sentiments like that, you know, later into the campaign. And when I say it was anathema to her, she's somebody who really believes that you change things by working inside the existing system. Bernie Sanders was saying we need to shake up or even destroy the existing system. Donald Trump, the same thing.
And you use the word revolution in this book.
Yes, in quotation marks, the Bernie Sanders revolution. Look, when he was a member of the Senate, I mean, he is a member of the Senate now, but when throughout his congressional career, I think most people looked at him as a revolutionary without any revolutionaries, without people following him. And that turned out to actually be a strength for him in really touching these sort of populist voters.
Although he also described himself as a socialist, but socialists might have disagreed.
Socialists might have disagreed. I don't think at this point you would describe him as a full bore socialist. But at the same time, he definitely practices a different brand of politics and a fire breathing brand of politics.
Now, you use the word miserable in your first chapter. You say that the campaign was miserable before it even started. In what way was it miserable?
These folks that were working on this campaign were at each other's throats. They were jockeying for position. Their candidate didn't have a message. Even before the campaign started, she had to go start talking about this email server that she had set up at her home outside the State Department system. This, and we go through this in detail in the book, just sort of all of the things that most campaigns don't have to deal with that these folks were dealing with every day they showed up in Brooklyn.
In March 2015, the Times reported that Hillary had used her email address as a personal server at their family home in Chappaqua to conduct official State Department business. The Times later almost became a cheerleader for Hillary Clinton. They probably had no idea what they were doing to her with that.
I think they had some understanding. I don't think they had an understanding of quite how far that would go. Certainly, she didn't have an understanding.
Could
of how
she have
far
managed
that
it better, or her team managed it better?
I think certainly it tied into a narrative that she was dishonest because she wasn't owning up to it and wasn't apologizing for it. And I think a lot of people saw that there was something, if not illegal, something wrong with that.
You, just about the time the story broke, you write that there were already factions in her team. There was the Robbie Mook Mafia, the State Crew, the Consultants, and the Communications Shop. Were they at war with each other? Did they have different visions of what the campaign should look like?
Oh, absolutely. And the real tension point, the biggest tension point, was between Mook, the campaign manager, and John Podesta, the campaign chairman. Podesta is a sort of old-school political guy. Mook, more millennial-minded, very into data. And Podesta, as we describe in the book, in this really sort of tense scene, basically halfway through the campaign, they're at a senior leadership retreat with everybody in the room, the top campaign brass in the room. And Podesta says, "Robbie's passive-aggressive, and I'm just aggressive." Mm-hmm. And their styles just completely clashed. Mook was always trying, in Podesta's view, Mook was always trying to hide information from him or not bring up problems as they arose. And in Mook's view, Podesta didn't understand modern politics and was kind of floating in and out.
And was that some of that revealed when Podesta's email server was hacked by, we're assuming, a Russian hacker, although we're still not 100% sure?
Well, I think we're pretty sure that this was a Russian-inspired hack, a Russian-driven hack, and we've heard reports from the intelligence community to that effect. Some of that was revealed in those emails, but honestly, because of the nature of what Podesta says about Mook about being passive aggressive. There's really, you know, that's where you have an absence of things going on. People not responding to emails. You know, one of the things that Amy and I found in reporting this book was that there really wasn't a clear leadership structure, and they struggled with that throughout the campaign. Eventually, Mook was essentially demoted a little bit. Without anybody announcing that, that was kept private. The chief strategist, Joel Benenson, was demoted without a change in title and replaced in a de facto way by Jake Sullivan, who was her policy chief. And, you know, Mook was sort of pushed into running the data for the campaign and the field operations and the budget, all of which ended up being controversial because there were people who thought he wasn't doing those things right.
Although we've seen similar things within the Trump campaign, and he still wound up winning the presidency. My guest is Jonathan Allen, who's covered national politics for Politico, Bloomberg, and Vox. He is also at Sidewire and writes a weekly political column for Roll Call. And he is co-authored with Amy Parnas, the senior White House correspondent for The Hill newspaper in Washington, who has covered both Hillary Clinton during this campaign and now covers the Trump administration. Their book, Shattered, Inside Hillary Clinton's Doomed Campaign, is published by Crown. We will continue our conversation after this. I'm back with Jonathan Allen, who is co-author with Amy Parnas of Shattered, Inside Hillary Clinton's Doomed Campaign. It is published by Crown. How much of this is all new material? Who did you speak to? Are the warring factions still at war with each other?
They're still at war with each other a little bit. They've been able, to some extent, to paper that over by blaming the election loss on factors outside the campaign, the FBI, and, well, as one of Hillary Clinton's friends put it, the FBI, the KGB, and the KKK. But there is still some tension that some residual tension there. We talked to more than 100 sources, and you know, in terms of the new material, I think there's new material on pretty much every page of this book.
And Hillary just recently also brought in misogyny as a reason that she lost. Was she talking about misogyny in general or misogyny in the way the media covered her?
Probably both. You know, it's interesting when you run a political campaign, you have to convince people to vote for you, whether, you know, whatever it is they do or don't like about you. And while, there may have been some misogyny in the media coverage and there may be some misogyny in the, and not only maybe, there is some misogyny in the electorate, her job as a candidate is to overcome that. I think there's a fair amount of racism in this country, and yet America elected an African-American president in 2008. So those are things that can be overcome by the right candidate.
What about the mess in connection to speech writing? She had some pretty good speech writers. Dan Schwerin was a chief speech writer, and then she, John Favreau, who had written for President Obama. But you get the feeling that there wasn't always clarity in the speeches. They were often written by committee?
They were often written by committee. In fact, that first speech that we were talking about a little bit earlier at Roosevelt Island, there were kind of a couple of sets of people working on it. Schwerin was running one process, and then Favreau was working with a former Hillary Clinton speechwriter, Lissa Muscatine, who now owns the bookstore Politics and Prose in Washington, D.C. And they were trying to come up with essentially different drafts of the speech. It went back and forth. Schwerin couldn't get Joel Benenson to sign off on it. He couldn't get Jennifer Palmieri, the communications director, to sign off on it. And then finally, toward the very end of that speech process, Hillary Clinton said, look, I'm just going to work with Dan, you know, one-on-one. And they put it together. But the problem was, as one of her senior aides put it to me and Amy, this senior aide said, I would have had a reason for running for president, or I wouldn't have run. And this was the conclusion of somebody internally who said that it just wasn't clear to anybody who was trying to develop her message what the key defining characteristic, overarching goal of her presidential run was. What is it that she wanted to do with that power? What were the one or two or three priorities she wanted, not what was everything she wanted to throw in there?
Well, defenders said that she you could criticize her for being an insider, but as an insider, she understood how government worked, and she would run an efficient government.
Sometimes the skills that it requires to run a government or to understand how the federal government works and winning the right to run that government are very different.
Donald Trump is being criticized for there being a certain amount of chaos within his administration, and so many of the people have had little experience in government.
That's euphemistic to say he's having a little bit of chaos. Donald Trump, came into the White House not really understanding the parts of the federal government or how they work, how to move those levers, and it shows the inability of the Republican Congress with the Republican president to move the Obamacare repeal and replace that they had put up there as an example, the executive order that was deemed unconstitutional by a federal court. And the second version of it, which was also blocked by a federal court. These are examples of a president who doesn't necessarily know the government as well as somebody like a Hillary Clinton.
When did Hillary and her team begin to take the threat of Bernie Sanders seriously?
I think she took the threat of Bernie Sanders seriously fairly early on. I would say the earliest we could trace it to is about May of 2015. But the advice that she got and that she followed, which I think is counter to her her general makeup and her general desire, was to not hit him real hard. That people thought on her campaign thought that would backfire, and in fact it ended up giving him a lot of oxygen. Maybe it would have backfired had they tried it, but he certainly got some traction over that summer while she was dealing with the email scandal.
And he successfully portrayed her as being out of touch with progressives. Why was she afraid to come across as more progressive? Was that her decision? Was that the advice of her team?
It's interesting. I think there were issues on which he was more progressive than she was, and particularly when you talk about the minimum wage. She would say, I'm for $12. He'd say, I'm for $15. One of her aides in the book said to us that the difference between them, and he's making a reference to the movie There's Something About Mary, where there's a Ben Stiller's character gets in a car with a hitchhiker, kind of a crazy hitchhiker guy, and the hitchhiker's talking about how he's going to make money beating the guy who does 8 minutes abs by doing 7 minute abs. And they said, Bernie, they would say, we're doing 7 minute abs. And he'd say, I'm doing 4 minute abs. And I think that was true on some of those issues, free college tuition rather than debt free college. But there were things on which she was more progressive. And I think that's particularly true when it came to matters of racial justice. And you'll notice one of the reasons she won the primary is because she was so effective at turning out African-American voters and running up huge delegate margins.
Although she also didn't come across as authentic to some people, there was the problem of not releasing the transcripts of her speeches to Goldman Sachs and Wall Street in general. The fact that she'd used that private server, although it turns out a lot of politicians have used their private servers, including the current vice president of the United States, people felt she wasn't authentic. Is that just her personality, or is that just the way she came across?
I think that one of the things that has happened with her over the course of her career, and I don't know how much of it is nature and how much of it is that nurture over the last quarter of a century of taking incoming fire, but she has a pretty thick skin and a pretty strong guard up around her, and that makes the things that she does seem inauthentic, even when they are authentic. Trump's sort of the opposite. He can lie to you and sort of come across as authentic.
My guest is Jonathan Allen, who with Amy Pernice has written Shattered, Inside Hillary Clinton's Doomed Campaign. It's published by Crown. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. Polls and data analytics have come under fire since the 2016 election because so much of the information they provided turned out to be wrong. Did her team rely on the polls and the data analytics too much?
That's certainly an argument that's made by the internal critics of Robbie Mook and some of her data analytics team and Clinton herself for following them. It's important, I think, to understand what the data analytics do, and there are a couple of different things that they do, but one of the things they do is try to determine which voters are with her, which voters are with Trump, and which voters are undecided, and then they try to make decisions about whether it's more efficient to turn out people who are with her or to try to persuade the other two categories to come to her. And what they decided was, and everybody would agree with this, it's more efficient to try to turn people out. The problem is when you start focusing on that base so much, your messaging to that base, you can alienate others. And so you kind of get into a death spiral of a narrowing base.
But she was relying on that data rather than going to some places. She's criticized for not visiting states that went to Barack Obama in 2008 and 2012, in some cases not at all or just barely. Why didn't she go more to Wisconsin, for example, or Michigan? Wasn't her loss to Bernie Sanders in Michigan a red flag?
In fact, we have a chapter titled Canary in the Auto Plant, that primary was, in fact, a harbinger of what was to come. She was shocked, and her data analytics people were shocked at the margins that Bernie Sanders got with women, white women in particular, whom he won. That was very surprising to them, and yet they didn't really correct for that. They didn't really correct for the working class whites in Michigan and Wisconsin and Pennsylvania who were drawn to Bernie and drawn to Trump but not to her.
I'm told by my staff that a listener is desperate for me to ask you about the DNC putting all of its support behind Hillary instead of listening to its base and doing more for Bernie.
So first, let me just say by way of a disclosure that I briefly worked for Debbie Wasserman Schultz many years ago for 40 days. So with that disclosure out,
And she was a guest on the show once. I don't know if that's if that's relevant or not.
It's no degrees of separation here. I think, you know, look, the Democratic Party had decided, the officials had decided that Hillary Clinton was likely to be the nominee pretty early on, and there was nobody who was seen as a credible Democratic candidate running against her. Part of that is because Bernie Sanders had not been a Democrat previously, and part of it is because they just didn't take him particularly seriously at the beginning. And I think the party behaved as though Hillary Clinton was going to be the nominee. And certainly Debbie Wasserman Schultz is somebody who was supportive of her in the past. Interestingly, a lot of the people on the campaign were not thrilled with, on the Clinton campaign, were not thrilled with Wasserman Schultz. And she, interestingly also, we report this in the book, she spent a lot more time personally talking to Bernie Sanders than she did to Hillary Clinton through the course of the campaign, negotiating debates and rules and party platform points with Bernie Sanders and with his wife, Jane Sanders. I think it is not something that's necessarily unique to this situation where you have a party that sees a clear front runner and sort of moves behind that clear front runner.
But for
that's
many,
not to say it's right. I actually think it's been bad for Democrats that they have such a thin bench.
For many people, the whole Benghazi thing was overblown, and she handled herself very well during her meetings with Congress. She handled herself well in the debates. Was she at all hurt by her performance in the debates?
I don't think she was hurt by her performance in the debates. I think that but I do think that Donald Trump's performance was underestimated. We go into deep detail into her debate prep. She was easily rattled in her debate prep sessions against her longtime aide, Philippe Reines, who played Donald Trump and even went so far as to get a special suit to wear and, you know, leg braces. And he you know, really played the part physically and was very good at getting under her skin in the debate prep, which was the idea. And her team was worried about that going into the debates with Trump, that he was going to be able to get under her skin. But the other thing that they discovered, and we go into detail about this, is that his message that being delivered by Reines, but it was the Trump message, was a lot of times easier for the audience to grasp than what Clinton was saying, even though she had a much greater mastery of the policy. And so I think on any traditional point, you would score her as the winner of all three debates. But Donald Trump clearly was able to communicate effectively with his voters.
I was just thinking about what would have happened if the election had gone the other way, and we would be having this conversation. We would be talking about the impact of the Access Hollywood taping of Trump and Billy Bush and the stalking during the debates and a few other things that made it look really bad for Donald Trump. Does it really matter in the end? Is this all just Monday morning quarterbacking?
Well, I think there are a lot of interesting
lessons. The Comey revelations, for example. Anthony Weiner.
So certainly a lot to this wild election to look into. I think, you know, the we talk about this in the book a fair amount, but the some of the bar for Donald Trump was low in terms of there wasn't an expectation that he was going to behave as a normal politician. And even I'm not sure how, like, the Access Hollywood video probably didn't help him, but it did in a way reinforce the idea that he wasn't your typical politician. And that's not to say that was that particular thing was positive for him. But I think a lot of these eruptions reinforced the idea that this guy was a disruptor and he was something different and he was change. With Hillary Clinton, she was trying to prove that he was too much change and she was so steady. And that reinforced the narrative that she was the status quo in terms of if she had won this election. And it would not have taken much to change the outcomes in those vital states. You know, Amy and I started reporting this book in late 2014, and right up until Election Day, you know, certainly on Election Day, we expected Hillary Clinton was going to win because we were looking at the same polling data that everybody else was. What was dissonant is we knew all of the flaws that had, you know, bedeviled the campaign throughout, and it didn't make sense to us that she was on the verge of winning despite all of what we had seen and all of what we had heard from her aides.
We were sorry that your co-author, Annie Prentice, couldn't be with you here today. How did the two of you – Amy, I'm sorry. How did the two of you come to work together?
We used to work together as reporters at Politico, and an agent, a book agent, approached us a few years ago to do our first book about Hillary Clinton, called HRC, which came out in 2014. In fact, we spoke about that book at the time, and you know, we thought it was a great idea that at that time it was like mid 2012. It was a great idea to sort of focus in on Hillary Clinton because it looked like she was going to run for president, and there was a reasonable chance she would at least be the Democratic nominee, if not the next president. So we've now been working on Hillary Clinton reporting for about 5 years together.
A lot of women were especially excited about the prospect of a woman becoming the first president of the United States. Their women have been leaders of countries all over the world, some less enlightened than the United States, in Asia, for example. But Britain has had two women as prime ministers. Germany has a one of the most powerful politicians in the world, a female prime minister. Why do you think she didn't get more of the women vote here?
Well, you know, I think that there are a couple of dynamics at play. One, and both parties recognize this, I think both campaigns recognize this, there was a limit to the degree to which her gender could be a persuasive factor in her favor. That is to say, people who wanted a woman to be president, most of them were already in her camp. So it was helpful in terms of getting them rallied, getting them together, getting them excited and volunteering, whether they're women or men or other gender identities. But what the Republicans saw in their early polling was it didn't, and they'd done a lot of research on her even before Trump was the nominee, was that it didn't really make the case for her to people who didn't agree with her.
And were they just assuming that African Americans, for example, would come out for her in the same kinds of numbers that they came out for Barack Obama?
They knew that it would be a challenge to match Barack Obama's numbers, but I think they underestimated the fall off, and they underestimated the degree to which younger African American voters, not all younger African American voters, but a lot of younger African American voters, would end up being angry at the sort of Clinton era of politics, particularly the 1994 crime bill, and she heard about that on the campaign trail. You know, people talked to her about her line about super predators in 1994, and You know, that was something that she had to overcome. That said, I think for the vast majority of African-American voters, I think there was a comfort level with her. And obviously she ran up the score with African-American voters, both in the primary and the general election.
Jonathan Allen is co-author with Amy Parnas of Shattered: Inside Hillary Clinton's Doomed Campaign. It's published by Crown. Thank you so much for being on our show again.